Welcome, everyone, to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today, we are excited to have Frances Fry and Anne Morris. Frances is a professor at Harvard Business School. She recently served as Uber's first senior vice president of leadership and strategy to help the company navigate its very public crisis in leadership and culture. Frances regularly works with companies embarking on large-scale change and organizational transformation, including embracing diversity and inclusion as a lever for improved performance. Her TED Talk on the topic of building trust has logged over 4 million views. That must be some sort of record. Wow. That's great. Anne is a highly sought-after leadership coach and the executive founder of the Leadership Consortium, a first-of-its-kind leadership accelerator that works to help more and varied leaders thrive. Her collaborators have ranged from early-stage tech founders to Fortune 50 executives to public sector leaders building national competitiveness. Anne has spent the last 20 years building and leading mission-driven enterprises, serving most recently as CEO and founder of Gene Peaks, which addresses the urgent need for better personal health information. You can find both of them on their website, The Leader's Guide, which signifies and highlights their new book, Unleashed, The Unapologetic Leader's Guide to Empowering Everyone Around You. You can also find Anne on Twitter at Anne with an E, Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S-S. Thanks, you guys, for being here with us. I am so happy that you're calling from Cambridge or at Cambridge, Massachusetts, and really appreciate your book's great. I got a lot of questions for you. You guys don't know that I've been doing this for about 15 years, and every single time, every month, and every time I always ask the same first question, which is, I read your bio, which are both amazing, especially those 4 million views, but I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your personal journey. Like, why did you decide to write the book? Kind of how did you get here and to writing the book? And then we'll go from there. So if you could each do that, that would be great.
Great. Yeah, and you can also find Frances on LinkedIn. Frances prefers to hang out on LinkedIn, and I prefer Twitter, which probably reflects our distinct personalities.
We can go into that if you want.
Can I start, Frances? Yeah. So I think we both got interested in leadership at a pretty young age. I think Frances probably on the basketball court. And I was a pretty weird little kid, but developed a fetish for the American Revolution at a young age. So there's a through line there. I think as soon as we picked our heads up and started looking around the world, but we really got interested probably in the early 2000s when we started working with organizations that were taking really big swings on changing their cultures with a sense of urgency, and we just loved the challenge and were really drawn to the challenge of doing things quickly, which we both have come around to as really the only way to really accomplish big change is to do it with a big mandate and a lot of speed. And, you know, a big pattern that we saw, which is one of the reasons we wrote the book, is that the leaders who were truly most successful at this organizational transformation challenge had a different way of being, you know, fundamentally being than their peers. Mm-hmm. And we summarized it as our first chapter, but it wasn't about them. It was about all the people around them. And they really woke up every day thinking about how do I enable the success of other people? And that is that's the jumping off point for the book and the core belief at the center of the work we do.
Yeah, I would add to that everything we have learned, we tried to put in the book in a way that it can be understood in our absence. And it's filled with lots of secret memos that I grew up feeling like I didn't receive a lot of the secret memos that other people did. And so this book is providing the secret memos on how to empower everyone around you and how to, like the difference between truly great leadership and average leadership. We think we've uncovered a few of the things and we really try to open source it with the book.
That's great. I'm going to go off topic here a little bit because I just heard from you that you played basketball. Did you play college basketball at Penn or high school?
I did. That was it was a long time ago when you didn't really have to be that good to play college basketball.
Well, I played college basketball too, at a liberal arts school, little Division III school, and college volleyball. And the reason why I'm asking this question is because I think that the way I look at leadership was formed very much doing that. And it goes to your notion very much of the leader is not the most important person in the room. And playing on a team sport, really, you really get that. So can you speak to that and speak from your experience as an athlete?
Yeah, I'm just going to have to dust the cobwebs off quite a bit. But I will say that, and one of the ways I think about it is, if you're on the court and it's not about you, you're doing a great job. So particularly in team sports, it's setting others up for success. When it's a individual sport, you're setting yourself up for success. And so the positions or the people were much better off when they were on the court than when they were off, regardless of their individual statistics. I think that's the way that's the way to think about it. And then in volleyball, which I played in high school, not in college, but it's totally like the setter. There are people who are as good as they are. That's how good the team is.
Definitely.
I think it goes there.
And I grew up playing sports. I wasn't as distinguished as Francis, my career. But I think the coach player metaphor also resonates when we talk about leadership. And the nice thing, I mean, the coach literally can't play. The game has to be played in her absence. And I think that's also a helpful way to think about, you know, how do I enable people who are out there on the field every day if when I'm not there and when I'm not literally kicking the ball or shooting the basket. And that's another, I think, powerful lens on what is real leadership and the practice of true leadership.
Yeah, I get more interested in Stephen Curry with his assists than I do sometimes when he shoots. I mean, because his assists are almost as good. So I think
his coach is pretty good too.
Yeah, damn good. Yeah. So this idea of assists, the setter is the one that's kind of quarterbacking the team, but has to be the one who assists the hitter. I mean, I think this is a great metaphor. So say more about that. You got this notion that the leader isn't the most important person in the room. So tell us more about that notion.
Sure. I mean, you know, part of the other thing that got us intrigued enough to write about it is that a lot of the stories we tell ourselves about leadership are very focused on the leader as the center of the action. And if you want to get better at this leadership thing, you know, we're typically told to focus even more on ourselves, you know, to hunt down our flaws and shortcomings and figure
dwell
on them, self-flagellate, you know, and just figure out how to fix ourselves. And so we start with this, you know, somewhat radical premise that you're all set the way you are. And what you really need to do if you want to get better at leadership is to look outward and focus on what the people around you need to thrive and be successful.
Right.
Yeah, and you use this great, you talk about Winston Churchill and that if he, like, he had plenty of flaws, and imagine if he had concentrated on those flaws as opposed to...
Yes, well, as we're learning, he was probably more deeply flawed than this heroic version of him, but I do love the image. I mean, you know, here is a man who, you know, changed history and stopped fascism in its tracks in many ways. And, you know, he, you know, could barely get through a meeting and would stay in his bathtub all day and, you know, had days when he wouldn't get out of bed. And what a tragedy it would be for, you know, the Western world if he had spent his time, you know,
on self-help.
Yeah. On self-help rather than
On his drinking problem.
I think, you know, it's we're not the first to say this, It's not about you, but here we are in 2020, and that idea has still not been internalized. I mean, look who's in the
White
House.
I get it. It's you know, we tend to look at we call them areas of opportunity, and we also try to look at strengths too, because you know, that they're both important. But this idea, this notion that making everyone else around you better is super important. So I definitely want to delve into that. You talk about these three core drivers of trust. can you go into that a little bit? You've got authenticity, logic, and empathy. And of course, you'll probably talk about trust first, I assume. Then after that, I want to get into some of what this pandemic has done and to leadership and get your thoughts on that. So,
sure. So the trust side, we found that trust was the foundation of much of human progress, not the foundation of much of human interaction. So we saw loads and loads of interactions that were not progressing anywhere. But the difference between the human interactions that had progress was that there was an underlying foundation of trust. And here was the big unlock for us, was when we found trust as a monolithic idea was not actionable at all. Like, people lamented when they had trust, when they didn't have trust, they were super psyched when they did, but they didn't feel like they could build more of it tomorrow than they had today. And the big unlock came when we found that trust actually has three component parts, as you said: authenticity, logic, and empathy. So you are much more likely to trust me if you believe it's the real me talking to you with rigorous logic, and I'm definitely in it for you, authenticity, logic, and empathy. Mm-hmm. And I only need one of those to start to go on tilt, what we call having a wobble. I only need one of those to wobble, and we like that because it's a temporary state. It's not a fatal characteristic. If one of them wobbles, you start to lose trust immediately. But if you know which one, if you can really come up with the careful diagnosis of which one, we have readily available prescriptions to overcome it. So if we can diagnose which of the three is at play, trust becomes super actionable, whether you're building it or rebuilding it. And so I think that was the first part. And then I don't remember your second question.
Oh, no, I just wanted you to explain the three. And
okay.
I like this idea of wobbling. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit. But one thing I want to, before you do that, though, you've been referring to the unlock and what you're noticing. So could you just briefly talk about your research, like how you came to this? I think that would be good for people to know.
Sure. So we tested this with over 100,000 individuals and hundreds of companies, and essentially bringing up instances where trust was broken down and diagnosing what was at play. And it turned out, we now summarize it as a trust triangle because there were three component parts. We're super open to there being a fourth. We would then morph it to a trust quadrangle. But it's stabilized as three. And then it also echoes back to logos, pathos, and ethos, which gave us confidence that the three could have some completeness to it. And so we curiously and tirelessly look for another cause. There just hasn't been one. So literally every company we could call all the time, every executive, if you have a trust breakdown, we can trace it to one of these three. And that's the thoroughness of it. And then the optimistic part of it is we can also show you how to overcome. And the book, you don't need us. The book is meant to exist in our absence. We also demonstrate how individuals and organizations can overcome each one.
Why don't you give us an example of one of them at this point, and then we'll go into the pandemic stuff.
Sure. So for a company, when I went to Uber in June of 2017, and I went there precisely because it was struggling, learned that trust had broken down with many of its constituents, Uber had been really geared towards riders, not as much towards drivers.
Mm-hmm.
It was creating a new industry, and so it had a really tense, non-trusting relationship with regulators. So it, and then the riders, who it really had just been centered around, the riders got super mad at how they thought Uber was treating the drivers. So it was essentially losing trust with every constituent.
Yeah, you had a bear situation there, for sure.
Yeah, right. It's,
yeah.
And then if you look, you know, at what happened, the culture and the trust was rebuilt with almost all of the stakeholders within 9 months. And that's internal employees, with driver, like it just, everything got better. It wasn't one solution. It was realizing that with the drivers, we really lacked empathy. And that the drivers, like, were just kept telling us the same thing, like, oh, my gosh, when we drive for Lyft, we can get tips. And when we drive for Uber, you're so rider-centric, but you won't let us have tips.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
We don't know how to say it in a way for you to hear it. In other constituents, it was, you feel very authentic, but, wow, the logic of that you have to work against us as regulators, even now when the industry has been established, doesn't make any sense, and that you should be partnering with us. And so when we could diagnose which one was at play, we could readily overcome it. So I think
mm-hmm.
now we're regulators first. We wouldn't go into a new environment where, and I still say we, because I can't,
mm-hmm.
I'll say we forever.
Mm-hmm.
But when we go into a new environment, we do it with regulators. We used to do it against regulators. And so I think with each constituent, we found out which was at play, and we were able to overcome them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. That's really cool. I mean, that there's so much to say about Uber, and I know you've also worked at WeWork too, so there's those two situations are both.
yes, all companies that begin with W. I'm waiting for Weight Watchers to call.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about the pandemic, because I think this has really tested our leadership and tested the way we interact with people, clearly. How has the last 6 months been as far as what you're noticing about how your view of leadership is altered at all, or what it takes to succeed?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anything you want to offer up in that, and then we're going to open it up for questions.
Sure. So it's a great question. Our working definition of leadership is to make others better as a result of your presence, and to make
mm-hmm.
sure that impact endures in your absence. So one of the things that has changed, you know, at a dramatic pace is that we're doing a lot more leading in our absence these days.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
From our worldview, you know, that if when you're leading your absence, you have a different set of tools, and things like strategy and mission and values end up mattering so much more, because your team and your colleagues and your employees are making a lot of decisions without you in the room. And it's critical that that mission and those values can really be guideposts, and that they're communicated really clearly.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing.
Did we just stop
go
for
ahead,
a second? I want you to say that
yeah.
again, because there is no room. There's a Zoom room. There is no
yeah.
room.
Yeah.
So I think this. I mean, what you just said is so important. I just want you to say it again. You know,
that's what I say
absence,
to her all the time. I just want you to say it again.
Yeah, I mean.
there's no room. There's no room. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no room anymore. Yeah, and the Zoom room is an approximation,
mm-hmm.
right? So people have, you know, an incredible amount of discretionary room to make
yes.
their own decisions.
Yes.
And so
yes.
it's more important than ever to make sure that your team understands your mission and values at a deep, intuitive level. They will be making lots of decisions without you, dealing with the unexpected without you, and that mission and those values have to be their guideposts.
And the way we think about that is that the two levers that you have are the mission, values, and you can summarize that. I think we can have that aggregate up to culture,
yep.
right? And then So there's strategy and culture are the two things that guide people for what to do. The way we think about it is that it's how well your strategy is understood, and then everywhere where strategy is silent, culture fills in the gaps. And so even though there's no room, I spend an awful lot of time on video. In fact, my eyes are sore. I spend so much time on Zoom. And we can see one another a lot. The difference is that there's no hallways. So I actually think there are rooms, but we don't have any of the informal conduits anymore. And so we have to be super deliberate and sometimes bring the hallways back into the room, but maybe onto the telephone room in that case and not into the
video
room.
And the water fountain's never coming back for public health reasons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, maybe the water cooler, but not the water fountain. Yeah.
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 I think the other thing is that we've been asked to get a lot more comfortable with discomfort and uncertainty as core leadership skills. Mm-hmm. And there are really big things that are out of our control right now, like basic things like, am I going to be able to open my doors to the public? And the faster you make peace with those things, the better off you're going to be as a leader. And I'll give you an example that's very close to home right now, literally. So we have two little boys. Not so little anymore.
Not so little anymore.
Yeah,
they're magnificent and wonderful.
Yeah. They're 9 and 12. One of them goes to, I'm going to try to get through this without.
Don't say any names.
Without saying any names. One of them goes to a very, tony, well-heeled school with a very defined way of doing things over the last century. Right? And the other one goes to this very scrappy, creative, startup-y type school. The startup dealt with the pandemic so much faster, more gracefully, more creatively. I mean, they had a functioning virtual school up and running
in like a minute,
within like a few days. Right? They were leaning into the problem. They accepted their reality and they moved right on to the creative solution phase. The 100-year-old institution.
Mm-hmm.
They took weeks
That's
to come online, and they wasted so much time and emotional energy being like victimized by this problem and
dwelling on what they were losing
and dwelling on the the loss and the tragedy of the kids no longer being on campus and being able to participate in these like beautiful rituals. And now I'm going to give myself away, but it was such a powerful lesson for us. That these things get dealt with and the entire organism of the institution responds to problems, even in your absence, and that's the only option you have right now. And that really starts at the top. The tone is really set by leadership.
Yeah, and it would be for the people that are listening that are optimization or math nerds, accepting the constraints for the constrained optimization, like just having peace with the constraints and then like flourishing within those, that's what dictates success. And lamenting the fact that we didn't used to have constraints and we now do, that dictates slowness.
And that, of course, just to reinforce the point, matters now more than ever.
More than ever.
Mm-hmm. I have so much to say about that, but I'm gonna open up the questions. I like so many comments. Anyway, I'm just gonna hold. Let's open up the lines. If you have a question or comment for Anne and Francis, just say your name first and then your comment or question.
Hi, this is Carol Rabach. And
hey, Carol.
The question. Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
The question that I had, and either one of you can answer it. I'm currently working with leaders who don't feel empowered themselves yet. So is there something in what you learned or in the book that supports them to feel empowered so then they can empower others? So we're starting with, unempowered people first.
Yeah, so a couple of things, and thank you for that question. A quote we have in the beginning of our book is by Toni Morrison, which is loosely, when you gain power, the the first thing you should do is look around and try to empower someone else. And so it's so if someone is not feeling empowered, I wonder if it's that they're not empowered or they're not feeling it. So we look for each person to empower others, but if you tell me you're not empowered, I would look to see, is it that you don't have power, or that you, it's almost like the equivalent to imposter syndrome. So imposter syndrome is when my actual abilities are high, but my perception of my abilities are low. And honestly, the only, nobody else can make us feel like an imposter. We do it to ourselves. So I would first say, is it that the person really doesn't have power, and then let's look how to get them power? Or is it that they have far more license than they're acting on, but they're risk averse for some reason? And then I would look, I would work on the emotional aspects of risk aversion. Here's the thing. We need, like, right now, we have to take chances. We, nobody, there's not a path for how to do this. And so I could easily see people being hesitant. And I would just say, have the courage to lead. Be super open about making mistakes. Be super open about the fact that first-time mistakes are not a bad thing. They're a beautiful thing. Second-time mistakes aren't awesome. But first-time mistakes, let's learn from them and spread that learning over everyone. And when you're going through a novel field, you have to make mistakes in order to learn. And so really, let's try to learn as much as possible. And if those of us that are feeling comfortable, learning should be on our shoulders. So I don't know if that helps.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah,
that does.
Thanks, Carol.
Yeah, all I would add is that if you're the leader in that situation, the place we would counsel you to start would be to start with trust. And if there is a breakdown in trust between you and your workforce that is feeling disempowered, to move through that question of, all right, is it authenticity, logic, or empathy that is breaking down in this relationship? And that's usually a powerful place to start to begin to empower the people around you.
Hey.
Thanks, Carol. Who's next?
Hey, Sue, it's Tawny.
Hey, T.
Can you hear me? Hey.
Yes, hi.
It's a great conversation. Can you talk a little bit more about teams where you have mistrust happening amongst team members, right? What do you suggest leaders do? So obviously you have your three categories here, but you know the situation I'm talking about, right? So maybe they all trust the leader, but they just don't trust each other, and it's just kind of breaking down the collaboration on the team itself.
Yeah, so the three levers, which are the ones that work, but I'll give you an example of where this was at play and how we overcame it. So when I got to Uber, everybody, you know, had a relationship with the leader, and then the leader left quite suddenly. And so it was just the senior team. And they had no experience working with each other. So when I was there facilitating the senior team, an odd thing happened. We were in person, and I noticed that people were multitasking during meetings. And then I noticed that the multitasking was texting. And so that's not great. Everybody knows that's not great. But then I found they were texting one another in the room about what other people were saying. So that's
right. Now, apparently this is like a typical Silicon Valley practice, but we were shocked.
Totally shocked.
Oh my God, you guys, that happens all the time.
The time.
we're dating ourselves. We could not believe it.
But if that happened, I just want to be super clear. Those teams are, I bet that they'll also say that they have too many meetings, and they have to relitigate things again and again, because that
and decisions get made out of the room, not in the room.
That behavior, you are suboptimizing on so many other things. And if you simply change the rule of the meetings to technology off and away, meetings will be shorter, decisions will be clearer, everyone will start feeling more included. And so I think inclusiveness is a big part here, and that's creating a really unsafe space. Even though we're all used to it, it actually is one of the largest time sinks. And so one of the things that I love Zoom, like with my heart and soul, but one of the things I don't like about it is that you can chat privately. It's taunting people to do this. And I observed firsthand what the damage is that it does. So even though we do it all the time, I would say if we can not do it, every single performance measure will go up. So if you're like all set with performance, keep doing it. But if you don't like how long meetings are and how much decisions have to be relitigated, and that decisions are made outside of the room, that's where I would go. That's where I would go for the source.
You can also scare people away from the private chatting by reminding them that the meeting host gets a transcript of the private chat.
Oh my goodness, I had no idea.
No one knows that.
That's awesome.
Two other. That's a great idea.
It happens in high school too.
Yeah.
High school Zoom. It's really bad.
Yeah, two other very practical tools I would offer that are tried and true in the group level trust situation. One, the group contract. It sounds silly and like a 1990s management tool, but it can work extremely well to make the behaviors that are undermining trust very discussable. So to put out on the table, what are the positive behaviors we're all going to commit to? And to even go so far as to, you know, sign those commitments or, you know, publicly commit to them, I think can be powerful. And then also in the book, I just offer that we do go through a trust diagnostic, a way to figure out what your wobble is. And for people to go through that exercise together in pairs and then to talk about it as a group, we've also seen that that be helpful.
Thanks, T. Does anybody else have a question or comment?
This is Deborah Frankquist. I have a question about the wobble. I love that metaphor. But we often, from the outside at least, we don't know that there's been a wobble until we actually see a collapse. And I'm wondering what you can say about, for someone inside, in your own leadership or in your own team, what are some clues that something is maybe not as stable as you keep trying to persuade yourself it is?
It's so good. It's such a good question. And, you know, we find that 80% of people have an accurate self-diagnosis. So more of us are pretty accurate when we do the diagnosis. But the challenge, of course, is you don't know if you're one of the eight or one of the two. And so what we have found, surprisingly, is that if you do this quick diagnostic and you show it to someone who knows you and loves you, they're going to say one of two things. One is, oh, my gosh, that's exactly right. That's what I've been trying to tell you. Then you know you're one of the eight. The other thing they're going to say is, holy cow, you continue to be delusional. So that means you're one of the two. And I would just take the person who knows you and loves you is more accurate because we're revealing who we are all day, every day. We just somehow sometimes get the lines crossed for ourselves.
Yeah, that's lovely. Thank you. That fills in the blank for me. And as I say, I just love that metaphor about the wobble because we do all know, at least we know what it feels like.
We totally do. And they're overcomable. We just got to make sure we don't fall down.
Yeah.
That's a great question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So I want to go back to, I love the way your book's arranged, where you have presence and absence. So we've talked about presence. We talked about trust. You also have love and belonging here. And then in the absence, you have the strategy and culture. You've talked about that a little bit. So can you speak a little bit more about love and belonging because we haven't really talked about that yet, and we'll go from there.
Sure. So the way to think about it is that if trust is the foundation of relationships, the first level is how can you bring out the best in one other person, like one person at a time, and if you can figure out how to do it, and we think you can do it with high standards and deep devotion, and I'll tell you what that is in a moment. But when you can bring out the best in one other person, that's like a beautiful act of love. So that's what we call love. And then the next ring of empowerment leadership, the next level is how do I bring out the best in a group of people and in particular, a group of people that is increasingly different than I am. And the reason we think that that skill is so important is that if I can bring out the best of a more varied group, it doesn't matter who you are or who I am, I'm going to win. Like, my team is going to win if I can bring out the best in greater diversity. The bringing out the best is inclusive of the diversity. And when we're the ultimate goal of being inclusive of difference is that everyone feels that they're of this place and they feel like they belong. So the love is how to bring out the best in one person. Belonging is how to bring out the best in more and more varied people.
That's a great way of putting it.
And when we were writing the book, like, the titles came to you. We didn't start with this structure and then write it down, but the words trust and love and belonging came to you as we were writing. I'm super curious where they came from.
Thanks for that question, co-author.
Oh, yeah. Anne is a beautiful writer, and I'm a helpful editor.
Well, I think the structure revealed itself, as you suggest, as we were writing the book. And what we realized was that we were really writing about how to lead at greater and greater scale.
Yeah.
And part of that was informed by, like, looking around, and this was pre-pandemic, but some of the other crises that we're wrestling with were already on the horizon, whether it's, you know, technology change or racial injustice or, I mean, these are big, you know, these are big, messy problems. And if we're going to solve them, we're going to need everyone, and we're going to need a lot of people off the leadership bench, and we're going to need the best of those people. And of course, that's the core mandate of leadership. You know, how do you set people up to thrive? But how do you also influence not just the small group, the people in front of you, but the people, you know, in whole organizations and in entire societies? And, you know, that's, you know, solving many of these problems are not just about, you know, are about influencing behavior, in some cases, of millions, if not billions of people. I mean, even something that seems so simple as wear a mask. You know, it's a much more complicated leadership challenge than just, you know, shaming people or telling them that it's going to be, you know, good for them to do what you want them to do. You know, we got to get a lot more creative and work harder as leaders to influence behavior at that scale.
And here's how you know that great leadership is occurring. And I do think that how leaders deal with the pandemic is a beautiful, beautiful metaphor in whether or not you're an effective leader. But I can probably get people who think like me to wear a mask. If I wear a mask, I can use my understanding. And that's also harkens back to the golden rule, which is treat others as you'd like to be treated. That, of course, only works when others are just like you. So for the more variation that we have, we need more variation to lead. And we have to learn how to lead people who are different than us. We have to treat others as they want to be treated, and we have to come up with logic and with stories and with narratives that work for different ways of thinking. And so we often think about leadership like belonging is when you lead difference. Like, if you can lead more difference than I can, you're going to achieve more. And here's like a fun test we do is use any metric you want and line up leaders by how much you think world leaders, it's all about them, and how much you think it's all about others. So how self-distracted and other-distracted they are. And then also just any metric you want to use, how well are they dealing with the pandemic? It's startling how correlated those two things are. It's startling.
Yeah, and there's a whole thing about women, how women are, you know, leading their countries. And I mean, it's stark. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And then you know, it's not that we would say that the gender is the causal. It's the other focus is causal.
Right. Exactly.
So empathy as a variable that matters.
Yeah.
I love that.
So we're stretching when we make those leaps. But yeah, it's the empathy factor for sure. Again, we can go off on that too, but we won't. So
are we going to have another conversation when we get to have all the things that we didn't discuss? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we can do that. you started talking about diversity and inclusion a little bit. You mentioned racial injustice. That is, in my life, it's been up for a long time, but there seems to be an opening right now that's different from before, and there's lots of reasons for that. So I'm going with it. I think it's great that we got this opening. So how do you see this work, this way you've set that? And again, I love the way that you guys have set this frame up here, this idea of belonging. What can you say more about the idea of promoting diversity and inclusion? And I'm not even sure if that's I actually am more apt to talk about anti-racism than that, but it doesn't really matter how we talk about it, what the word is. I want you to talk more about how you're seeing that work unfolding and you could particularly talk about what you're doing now with that and also what you did like at an Uber or some other places.
Sure. And we do it with each company that we work with. And the reason we're super optimistic now is that we used to be the people that brought up race. And now when we go into companies, race is already being discussed. And
right.
So we need to take advantage of this moment in time because it's for whatever mm-hmm. set of circumstances, I'm not sure
right.
what it is, but race is being discussed. And so we have
yes.
to use it. So here's, we can define what the end state looks like. And then we could talk about the paths to get there, independent of the language that we're going to use. So the end state is when there are no longer demographic tendencies associated with who's thriving. So if there are demographic tendencies associated with, what your ethnicity is, or which gender you are, or any attribute, we're not done. And we can talk about how to overcome it. But when there are no longer demographic tendencies associated with who's thriving, and thriving is like sentiment and achievement. If there's no longer demographic tendencies associated with who's thriving, we're done. If there are, we got to work on that with as much like can-do, rigorous root cause analysis as the people that have learned how to like land a spaceship on Mars. Which is, that took a lot of trial and error and a lot of experimentation, but they never lost sight of what the goal was. I think what we need to have here is not to lose sight of when we're done and then apply root cause analysis and rigor and optimism and treat it like every other change process that we've ever done.
Totally. I mean, one pattern that we saw in Silicon Valley in particular, although we've seen this everywhere, is that you had leaders and entrepreneurs with incredible vision and audacity. These are people disrupting whole industries, putting people on the moon, getting paralyzed by diversity issues, and
it didn't make any sense,
getting very intimidated by making progress because it's an emotional, messy, politicized issue. And where we would push them is like, listen, like, you are problem-solving machines. trust yourself. Like, let's break this down into its component parts, just like any of the other organizational problems you solve all day, every day. And in some places, that was really the unlock. And, we get very practical very quickly. Like, let's look at the HR life cycle. Let's start with recruiting. How do you recruit incredible people?
Mm-hmm.
How do you, set them up to succeed with an inclusive culture? How do you invest in them from a development standpoint? How do you promote them? How do you, work hard to retain them once you've made all these investments and the recruiters start calling? So it's, Francis and I joke, let's bring some can-do lesbian spirit to this problem, boys. let's roll up our sleeves and get in there. And that's, I think,
awesome.
Like ratcheting down the stakes of this, ironically, because in many ways, like it is everything. Like, how do you acknowledge the humanity of your, the person across from you? But in some ways, it's helpful to flip that and say, like, let's just start solving problems.
Let's keep it as a priority. Let's start solving problems. We find that progress is made so quickly when we remove our are being paralyzed by the emotional, political aspect of it. And if we just start treating it like every other problem, super rapid. So it's like there are not very many Black people in your organization. As Anne said, you are either have a selection, development, promotion, or retention problem.
Yeah.
There's not a fifth one. There's only four, and we're going to go figure out which one it is, and then we're going to double-click on how to fix that one.
So this is great, you guys. Thank you. It's great. How are you finding you're using diversity and inclusion as part of an overall change process, which I love. And you're now finding the situation that we're in right now, where I just noticed, and as you said, that people are actually talking to you about race. Can you talk a little bit about being white going into these conversations and talking about race? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, when it's successful, like, we want people to be able to lead people that are very different from ourselves. So if I'm sensitive and caught up that, oh, I'm white, so I should only talk about the things that I have direct experience of versus I want to unleash everyone, it will, of course, be easier for me to unleash people that are just like me because I can follow my instincts. And the more different people are, the less I can follow my instincts and the more deliberate I have to be about it. But we want people to be able to lead all kinds of difference. The most stubborn difference in the United States, by far, is race. We've been battling it for 400 years. I think that we have an opportunity right now for whatever series of events to address it. But we're going to address it the same way. So I think it goes well when you're realizing you have to lead difference. I think it goes badly if you think, oh, I've experienced sexism, so that means I know about racism. I don't think one ism works over to the other. So as long as we understand that we're leading difference, which means we're not going to rely on our instincts, we're going to be far more systematic and far more diligent and deliberate about it, I think as a white person unleashing, I mean, I know when I'm done, right? We're done when there are no longer demographic tendencies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it also, like, we come at this work from the perspective of we want to make organizations better.
Yeah.
Right? And we went into it very open, you know, very intellectually open about, you know, where can we find those levers for performance. Now, it turns out, you know, inclusion is an enormous lever to make an organization better.
Yeah.
And that's the energy we bring to this. Again, it's very practical. I mean, Francis, you have an operations background. You know, I have an entrepreneurial background. We like to solve problems. And this is the fastest way we discovered to make an organization better is to figure out how to get full access to the difference that's already there, but also bring in different points of view and then set those different points of view up for success. And so that's how we approach the work. Now, it happens to align with our own personal values. You know, if we had discovered that it was, you know, tobacco,
we wouldn't have written a book about
it. You know, that really unlocked performance, which maybe it does. You know, we probably wouldn't spend our lives doing this, but you know, we want to make organizations better. We want to help people make other people better, and creating inclusive environments is a very effective way to do that. Which is why when we talk about leadership, we don't talk about inclusion as this like side hustle on your way to being a great leader, which is how it's often discussed. You know, it's a central part of your mandate to integrate. It's part of everything you do to enable the success of the people around you and enable the success of more and varied people around you.
And then you get to thump everyone else in terms of a performance, which we're both enormously competitive.
We're crazy competitive. I mean, I hide it a little better than Francis. but not much. And we want to win. And, you know, we want to. Yeah, I have like this Midwestern, you know, nice Midwestern background. You know, Francis is from New York, but we've come to win, and I think that's why we love partnering with other competitive leaders who are in it to bring home the prize for themselves and their teams.
We had a sports competition on our second date. I think it was a foot race.
Amazingly, Francis tied. There's no way.
Explanation for that. Other than desire to win.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for this. You guys are. I'm glad you finally came out because I was like wondering. It's like it wasn't obvious at the beginning. Yeah. So we got that now. Thank you. Thanks for your guys are a good act together, I'll tell you that. Thanks for being with us, and I wanna highlight again their book, Unleashed: The Unapologetic Leader's Guide to Empowering Everyone Around You. You know, I've done this a lot. I've done this 15 years, and it's 15 times 12, however that is. So, you know, I can say right now that this book, this idea, these ideas are definitely, you know, top of the heap. So if you want competition, you guys won the competition.
Yes!
Yeah, top of the heap.
That's
yay. Yeah, that's what you're hoping for, right? So seriously, I really want to thank you because I think you got a lot of – I love the framework. I'm a framework person. I love the framework. And I just want to wish you luck because I think you're doing a lot of great stuff. So thanks for being with us.
And thank you so much for facilitating this conversation. It was terrific. And if you ever want to invite us back to have the talk about all the things we're going to talk about another time, we're in. We're in.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, it's total awesome. Selfish pleasure to be a part of this. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's fun. So let me just talk a little bit about, remember, leadersguide.com is how you can get a hold of these guys. And also, Anne is at Anne Morris. That's two N's and two R's and two S's.
and a silent E.
A silent E, right. So it's ANNEMORRISS. And then you can catch Francis on LinkedIn. Next month, everybody, we've got Yvonne Wassenaar, and she's the CEO of Puppet, an IT automation software company in Portland. This is a treat because we don't get actual CEOs, you know, people inside as often as we do people outside. So this is a treat to have Yvonne with us. That's on September 29th at 1 p.m. Pacific. So I want to invite everybody to come and be here with us then. And also we will have, again, everyone, thanks for being with us. And I wish everyone well. I certainly, those of us who are in the Bay Area, we've got to just hang together here about these fires and send out good vibes to all the firefighters. And stay safe and wear your masks. Bye now.
Yes. Bye. Thanks so much.